Hi. Good morning. Another dreary morning. So I'm going to give a series of two talks. One talk today and one in 4 weeks on Chuang Tzu. The early Taoist teacher. He's the second best known Taoist teacher. The first is Lao Tzu. And I'm doing this partly because I'm going to be leading a study group starting on April 25th, in which we're going to read this book on Chuang Tzu. So if you listen to my talks, you don't have to come to the study group. Or you might get so fascinated by the material that you want to read it. You want to read it and want to come to my study group. Either way, pretty good. Pretty good. So, the Taoists. So the Taoists, particularly Chuang Tzu, say each of us is an integrated part of this cosmos, including that fly there. Our inner world, the microcosm in here, is a reflection of the outer universe, the macrocosm. And the outer is a reflection of the inner. And nature, Tao, is a life force which expresses itself through all things. Through all things. Through each of us. Through that fly. Through all things. Although we experience ourselves as separate, I experience myself as separate from Paul, we're a single awareness expressing itself through different forms. Wow, look at all the forms. Like clouds and ice created from water. It's all water, and yet there's clouds and there's ice. We're all temporary expressions of this one Tao. We're all fleeting formations that create new and wonderful combinations. It's a creation that goes on and on and on and on. Come on in. There are seats back there. And there are probably seats over there, too. No. And how do we get in touch with this, says Chuang Tzu? Well, Chuang Tzu tells us it's pretty simple. All we have to do is empty our boats. If a man is crossing a river and an empty boat collides with his own skiff, even though he be a bad-tempered man, he will not become very angry. But if he sees a man in the boat, he will shout at him to steer clear. If the shout is not heard, he will shout again and yet again and begin cursing, and all because there is somebody in the boat. Yet if the boat were empty, he would not be shouting and not angry. If you can empty your boat, crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you. No one will seek to harm you. Not only that, says Chuang Tzu, we'll have some wisdom, some simple wisdom, simple, ordinary wisdom. So Chuang Tzu tells us to become the true person of Tao. And to do that, all we have to do is sink into our rootedness in the great mystery. Well, that's all we have to do, sink into our rootedness in the great mystery. Our vitality, our power are hidden there, right here in the great mystery. A wedge cannot enter as long as we are just who we are. A wedge cannot enter as long as we are just who we are. So there's a practice period going on now, which Ted is leading. Ted and Mark are leading, and they're focusing on bodhisattvas. And I'm hearing wonderful things about what they're doing and how it's helpful to people. But someone came to me. I was having a one-to-one with someone who was in the practice period, and she said, "Geez, all this stuff about being a bodhisattva, and I'm just not living up to it. I don't know how to do it. It's awkward, and these people are doing all these things, I can't do any of these things. I feel like I'm really a bad bodhisattva. I'm really out of it, and I don't know how to do it. I've never done these active things in the community. So I said to her, just try to be who you are right now without comparing or judging. She's only getting freaked out because she's comparing herself to all those other people. But if she's just who she is, then she's just naturally, spontaneously able to be a bodhisattva. That's Chuang-tzu's teaching. It's a very simple teaching. That was Katagiri Roshi's teaching. That was Suzuki Roshi's teaching. Very simple. But we feel not okay and inadequate, so we want to add something on and get something. So that's why we need to read these guys, these women, over and over and over again until we get them, in ourselves. So, Buddhism and Taoism. Now, Taoism is already in China when Buddhism comes in. Buddhism comes into China, Taoism is there. And Buddhism is the father of Zen, and Taoism is the mama. The mama. The papa and the mama come together. They procreate, and then we have Zen. 6th through the 10th century. Wonderful Zen because of this wonderful procreation, this wonderful intercourse. Cool. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the father and mother coming together. So four ways in which the father, there's the father of Buddhism and the mother Taoism, and they come together with in the teachings of Chuang-tzu and to a lesser degree Lao-tzu. And some of their disciples, although they didn't claim they had any disciples, actually didn't believe in that stuff, but people who hung out with them and wrote stuff. And so I'm going to talk about two today and then two in 4 weeks. Just before we start the study group. So the first one, Buddhism, as the father, emphasizes restraint, discipline, hard work. Taoism, as the mama, emphasizes laughter, play, and spontaneity. So, starting with a papa. So let me do the next two also, which I'll be doing next time, and see if you can remember them for 4 weeks. So the third one, the father, sensual pleasure is suffering. Sensual pleasure is suffering. It's dukkha. It's fraught with dukkha. The mama, sensual pleasure is wonderful, including sex. Wonderful. Well, that's for next time, you guys. And the fourth one, from the papa, the scriptures are important. The verbal teachings are important. They guide us. We need them. We need them. They're the main thing. The Taoists say, oh, no, they're not the main thing. They're okay if you really want to do them, but nature is the main thing. Be in nature. Pay attention to the sky and the earth. Be with it. That's the main thing. So that's for next time. Anyway. So back to number one. Number one. The father has restraint, discipline, and hard work. So Miles Davis, the trombonist, somebody approached Miles Davis and said, boy, that trombone that you play, that's amazing. Can you give me some tips? Can you teach me? Looks like Jeffrey already knows the answer to this one. And Miles Davis said, blow, blow. And the guy went back, and he went home, and for a year he practiced, and he blew and blew and blew. And it was awkward, and his mouth was sore, and his jaws were sore, and he was stumbling all over the place, and he came back a year later and he said, well, Mr. Davis, I did what you said, but I can't do it. Give me some more tips. And Miles Davis said, blow, blow, blow. That's the story. That's the story. So through this discipline of sitting, doing walking meditation too, sitting, we develop a muscle. It's like doing sports. You develop a muscle when you do lift the same weight over and over again. We develop a muscle. A muscle that's able just to be present, just to open up. But it takes the 10,000 hours that I always talk about. Sorry. Maybe you can do it in 5,000. Or maybe 3,000. That's fine. So, here at Zen Center, I am no longer the only teacher. We have several good teachers, and all those teachers were priests in training with me for a while. And now we have other people here today who are priests in training, and who are priests in training to be. And talk about restraint, discipline, and hard work. Ask them about it. Ask them about what they have to do, how much sitting they're expected to do, 18 retreat days a year, and how much vacation do they get a year. Maybe we're getting less and less vacation these days. So maybe they get 15 days of vacation and they have to do 18 retreat days? Restraint. You have to really restrain yourself, to discipline yourself. And our icon, our favorite icon in Zen is who? Bodhidharma. He's the original guy. How long did he sit for?
9 years.
Yeah, what happened to his legs? They fell off. They fell off. Oh, boy. That's a selling point for meditation, isn't it? That's a real selling point. Restraint, discipline, hard work. Just to restrain yourself for the 20 minutes here that you were sitting, or 40 minutes, when your nose was really itching, when you had to pee, or when, you know, your mind was all over the place, just to do that. Good. Good. Over and over and over again. That's the papa. Well, luckily we've got the mama too. Luckily. The mama. Humor and laughter, play, spontaneity. Here's Chuang Tzu. When the lofty hear of Tao, they devote themselves. When the common hear of Tao, they wonder if it's real or not. When the lowly hear of Tao, they laugh out loud. Without that laughter, it wouldn't be the Tao. So being lowly, that's Chuang Tzu's advice, to be lowly and laugh out loud. Not comparing. Don't compare. You can be as low as possible. If you're just with it, you'll laugh out loud. So humor. Humor breaks down the division between the beautiful and the ugly, right? The spiritual and the material, the sacred and the profane. It breaks down that division. We get caught. We only want the good side. We don't want the bad side. So we're always going for the good side. We get caught. Humor opens us up, breaks down that dichotomy, that division in our psyches, which causes so much stress, so much tension, so much anxiety. It's hard to actually experience anxiety when you do a belly laugh. Try it. The division between the beautiful, the ugly, the spiritual and the material, the sacred and the profane. Broken down. So, this is actually a story that I have never told. Sometimes stories come to me, memories come to me with my first teacher that I didn't even, that I've forgotten all about. let's see, how can I tell this story without going on and on? Because I need to discipline myself and get through this talk in 48 and a half minutes or something like that. 49 minutes maybe before Ted looks at me. Let's see, what was I talking about? Oh, yeah, a story. So when I was with my first teacher in San Francisco, Bishop Sumi had come to visit us. And you know, they have bishops in Soto Zen. He was the man. Bishop Sumi was the man. And he was a lot more Buddhist than he was Taoist. Pretty Buddhist. So he said, he gave us a little talk and he said, when Suzuki was talking, we should sit perfectly still. And if we couldn't sit in half lotus, we could sit in quarter lotus. But none of that stuff, you get kicked out. Even none of that stuff, even no seiza. Seiza, not allowed. Not Buddha's way. And he was very elegant and carried himself very upright, in an upright way. Very dignified. And then he said, and then when Suzuki is talking, don't look at him. Don't look at him. What? Don't look at him. No, no. Not Buddha's way. Eyes forward, half eyes half closed, just like Zazen. His talk is Zazen. You do it like Zazen. So, and Suzuki, when he talked with us, he stood. We were in chairs, and he stood on Sunday mornings. Maybe so, I guess so we could see him. He stood for his talk. So then Bishop Sumi left. And then we were really trying to do this, like Bishop Sumi told us, because Suzuki said, Bishop Sumi, pay close attention to Bishop Sumi, and you will learn something very deep. We didn't know if we wanted to learn anything that deep, but we did our best. So then Suzuki is giving a talk one morning, and he's talking about Kakuen, the monkey man. In Chinese folklore, who is very obstreperous and does some awful things too, even abducts women and has illicit intercourse with them. And then, so people were trying to stop Kakuen. This is all I remember from the story. Trying to stop Kakuen. And so they lit a fire around him. And then Suzuki said, and then Kakuen pulled out his best hose, and he went like this, and he sprayed the fire. And we all just broke out in laughter. Wild laughter. That's the whole story. You can imagine the Zen teacher standing like this and spraying us all with his best hose. So this is an entree into some Zen jokes that I prepared particularly for this occasion. None of them are mine. They're all plagiarized. Six Zen jokes. A Zen student went to a temple and asked how long it would take him to gain enlightenment if he joined the temple. 10 years, said the Zen master. Well, how about if I really work hard and double my effort? 20 years. Second story. Seeing his master on the other side of a raging torrent, a student waved his arms and shouted out, Master, Master, how do I get to the other side? The master shouted back, You are on the other side. For his 70th birthday, one of his students gave the Zen master a big box with a ribbon around it. When the master opened the box, he found that there was nothing inside. Aha, he exclaimed, just what I wanted. Now you're all going to be giving me empty boxes. You gave me turtles. I said, no more turtles. And I don't have room on my altar for empty boxes. An aspiring monk asked to enter a temple and attach himself to a guru. Very well, said the guru, but all students here observe the vow of silence. You will be allowed to speak only once in every 12 years. After the first 12 years, the student said, The bed is too hard. After another 12 years, he said, the food is not good. 12 years later, after 36 years of hard work and meditation, he said, I quit. Good, snapped the guru. All you have been doing is complaining. A Zen student asked his master, is it okay to use email? Yes, came the reply, but no attachments. That's an ancient one. That one's from the 6th century. Two old friends met for dinner. How's that husband of yours? Is he still unemployed? No, not anymore. Oh, well, some good news at least. What does he do now? Now he meditates. Meditates? What's that? I'm not sure, but it's better than sitting around doing nothing. Though I have lots more, but... Well, anyway, you get the idea. It's not an idea. It's just opening up to being here. To being here. To being available. So what about the complementary relationship between the father and the mother? Well, here's a long Dao Chuangzi story about the complementary nature between work, discipline, and spontaneity. And some of you know this story. This is a pretty well-known story. Ting, the cook, was cutting meat free from the bones of an ox for Lord Wen Hui. His hands danced as his shoulders turned with the step of his foot and the bending of his knee. With a shush and a hush, the blade sang, following his lead, never missing a note. Ting and his blade moved as though dancing to the mulberry grove, or as if conducting the Qing Shao with a full orchestra. Lord Wen Hui exclaimed, what a joy! It is good, it is not, that such a simple craft can be so elevated. Ting laid aside his knife. All I care about is the Tao. I find it in my craft, that's all. When I first butchered an ox, I saw nothing but ox meat. It took 3 years for me to see the whole ox. Now I go out to meet it with my whole spirit and don't think only about what meets the eye. Sensing and knowing stop, the spirit goes where it will, following the natural contours, revealing large cavities, leading the blade through openings, moving onward according to the actual form, yet not touching the central arteries or tendons and ligaments, much less touching bone. A good cook needs sharpen his blades but once a year. He cuts cleanly. An awkward cook sharpens his knife every month. He chops. I've used this knife for 19 years, carving thousands of oxen. Still, the blade is as sharp as the first time it was lifted from the whetstone. At the joints, there are spaces, and the blade has no thickness. Entering with no thickness where there is space, the blade may move freely where it will. There's plenty of room to move. Thus, after 19 years, my knife remains as sharp as it was that first day. Even so, there are always difficult places, and when I see rough going ahead, my heart offers proper respect as I pause to look deeply into it. Then I work slowly, moving my blade with increasing subtlety until, kerplop, meat falls apart like a crumbling clod of earth. I then raise my knife and assess my work until I am fully satisfied. Then I give my knife a good cleaning and put it carefully away. Lord Wen Hui said, that's good indeed. King the cook has shown me how to find the Tao to nurture life. So we can see this. He put in his 10,000 hours, right? And then he was able to move his blade as though dancing to the Mulberry Grove, whatever that is, or as if conducting the Qing Sha with a full orchestra. This is the fourth century before the contemporary era. We should Google what the Qing Sha is. I bet we could find out, right? So that's how they come together. But it doesn't necessarily have to be before and after. You might think, oh, because the mama and papa are always there together. It's not like you have to do all this papa and then have mama later. Mama's here. Don't worry. You can do both. You are both. You are both. You're yin-yang. This is yin-yang. You are it. So part two is the father as an icon. The father as a perfection or the symbol of perfection. And the mother as iconoclasm or imperfection. So let's start with perfection, the papa. In all of these things that we've chanted and these ordination ceremonies and things we've done for years, it talks about Buddha as the perfect teacher. Buddha's teaching as the perfect teaching. Although I've actually changed it in the ceremonies we do for initiation, for ordination, from perfect to complete, because I'm so Taoist that I had to do that. But I don't want to mess with it too much because it's come down for centuries and there's something important in there. And then when we chant the Heart Sutra every morning. I've been doing it with a gap of a few years for 50 years every morning. And first it seems like we're letting go of everything. We're know this, know that, and know that. And then we end up saying that we attain unsurpassed, perfect, complete enlightenment. Wow, unsurpassed. Anybody want to do that? Perfect, complete? And then our altar. We have our altar. Our altars are done. Buddhist altars are done in a way. To honor Buddha, to honor the icon. There's a specific way of doing them, and they symbolize that urge for perfection, for perfect enlightenment. And then we have in Buddhism something called the six perfections or the ten perfections, depending on whether you do early Mahayana or late Mahayana. The six perfections, the six paramitas. And since people get hung up on the term perfection and they forget the mama part, I translate it as the six gone beyonds, because that's the literal translation, rather than perfections, because then people get, oh, I can never do this. So anyway, but the six perfections, generosity, perfect morality, perfect patience, perfect effort, perfect meditation, perfect wisdom, prajna paramita. So that we want perfection is good, that we're moving toward perfection. It's good. We want perfect enlightenment. We want to be perfectly composed and available to life and helpful to others and joyful within ourselves. We want that. It's a human thing. It's cool. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And we aspire for that. As I always say, it's important to pay attention to our heart and our aspiration rather than our head and our expectation. Because then the perfectionism becomes something very rigid, very calcified. But if we come back to our heart, yes, our heart wants to open to all beings, wants to move beyond all these projections that we do. At the same time, the mother, imperfection. Japanese art, Japanese flower arrangement, Japanese pottery, Japanese tea ceremony, the underlying principle is wabi-sabi, which comes right from the Taoists. Right from the Taoists. Wabi-sabi. It's an aesthetic of incompleteness and transiency. Everything is incomplete. Everything is imperfect because everything is changing. Everything is changing. So that's a Japanese aesthetic, which is a very beautiful expression of Taoism, appreciating the integrity of natural objects and processes. So I'm passing around two cups here, which you can look at. These are not the best examples I could find of Raku pottery, which is based on this aesthetic. And I didn't look around. I just went in our cupboard in the kitchen. So they're not exactly the real deal. But who cares what the real deal is? Everything is the real deal, right? But you'll notice that they're flawed. They have flaws in them. Purposeful flaws. They're kiln dried and baked with the flaws in them on purpose. They're asymmetrical. These are a little too symmetrical, but generally they're asymmetrical because they're not done on a wheel. They're rough. They've got the roughness. You appreciate. You feel the roughness. And they're simple. And they speak to us. They speak to us. So that's imperfection. Imperfection. And the story that's in my book that I'm going to tell a very abbreviated version of now. When I was with my teacher, my first teacher, I'd had a Kensho experience, a Satori experience, and of course I wanted complete, perfect enlightenment. Of course. Perfect enlightenment. Unadulterated. So I wouldn't have any of this psychological pain anymore. So I was going to go to Japan and practice then, and I was looking at lots of different places I'd go. I only wanted to go just the right place. I'm going to go all the way over there. I want to go to a place where there's a really deep teacher and, get to sit all the time and, they give you all the instruction. So I, I was doing this. I don't think I was talking to Suzuki about it, but maybe I was and I just don't remember. Then I was having breakfast with him once and I started talking to him about, I was thinking about this one or this one and that one or that one and the advantages and disadvantages. And what did he do? He pointed to the cupboard to the side and the shelf. It was an open cupboard where it was full of Raku pottery, real Raku pottery. And he said, if you try to find the best one of those, you will not appreciate any of them. That's all he said. The whole end of story. Then I didn't go to Japan. I stayed with him. That's not quite the end of the story. He suckered me into staying. So here's a poem by Lao Tzu. Nothing lasts. Nothing is perfect. Nothing is complete. True perfection is imperfect, yet it is perfectly itself. Then it is perfectly itself. So if we're just perfectly ourselves without getting hung up on all this judging, all this evaluating, we're bodhisattvas. We're natural bodhisattvas. Naturally we reach out and support people because we're perfectly who we are. And we all do it in a different way. Some of us may be political activists. Some may not be at all. It's totally irrelevant. Just be ourselves. May 100 flowers bloom. May 70 flowers bloom. Dogen, a Zen teacher's life is one mistake after the other. One flawed piece of Raku pottery after another. with its imperfections, its mistakes, right, burned into it. Right? Then we experience its aliveness. We appreciate its aliveness. And it's transient. So iconoclasm. Iconoclasm. I talked about it. The icon now, we're doing the mama, right? Iconoclasm. Now, what did Abby Hoffman say about this? Anybody know? He said, every ism is a wasm. Every ism is a wasm. You got it? It's all about the past. We want to do it like that. They did it in the past because that was the right way. We're just so messed up. We've got to do it that way. But it's all a wasm. So Buddhists, Buddha was supposedly was he getting ready to die, supposedly. And he was supposedly, one of the stories is he was getting ready to die because people were turning him into an ism, into an icon. So he said, I'm out of here. And then he ate some poisoned pork or something. And then his last words, monks, be a light to yourselves. Seek your own salvation. Monks, be a light to yourselves. Seek your own fountain. Salvation. So for 250 years after Buddha's death, there are no pictures of Buddha. There are no Buddha statues because Buddha was not into that stuff. But people couldn't resist. People couldn't resist. So then they began doing pictures first on rocks and then pretty much statues and then pretty soon altars. So by 300 years after his death, there were Buddha statues and icons all over the place. Then another, but they're still representational. 250 years, they're a representation of him as a human being. Then another 250 years. What happens? The birth of Mahayana. What happens in the birth of Mahayana? Well, read the Lotus Sutra. All of a sudden, the Buddha has turned into a transcendent deity. He's all knowing. He's omniscient. He's omnipotent. He's like God the Father in the New Testament, only he takes lots of forms. There are lots of Buddhas. There are lots of God the Fathers. So we see how we get caught, how we want something. We want something. We get caught by some idea. And so the Taoists are just reminding us that caughtness only causes suffering. Then we start having religious wars. Or whatever. Whatever. So, golden age of Chinese Zen, they're collapsing the divisions between the sacred and the profane. They're collapsing. Monk asks Wumon, oh, yes. Well, thank you. They're collapsing the divisions between Buddha and us. Us imperfected, monkey-minded, whatever we are. And so the monk asks, so there are lots and lots of stories like this. Monk asks Wumon, what is Buddha? He says, dried dung. Dried dung. So, which reminds me of my grandsons. You know, I always have to have something remind me of my grandsons because I got to bring them in. I got to bring them in here because I don't know why. I love them so much. And you guys would love. If you don't have grandsons, maybe you have grandkitties. You can love your grandkitties. It's all the same. You know, it's all the same. Why am I telling this story? Let's see. Dried dung. When my grandsons were like 4 and 8, I think, my daughter Erin started saying to them, no potty talk, boys. Every time they start to talk what she called potty talk, which is a lot, she'd remind them, no potty talk. No potty talk. So finally, after about 2 years, they don't do any potty talk in front of her, just in front of Grandpa. Because Grandpa laughs. Grandpa's not supposed to laugh, I guess. But these Chinese Zen masters, they're not, and Suzuki Roshi himself with his hose, they're not trying to do potty talk. They're trying to help us just collapse this kind of division that we set up between how we think we should be a certain way. And if we're just with what is, we're just fine. We're just fine. So the Tang Dynasty teachers have lots and lots of potty talk. I could give you 2 pages of potty talk or 4 pages. But it's not just the way my grandsons do it. It's to break down this kind of how we get hung up on what's right and what's good and what's real and what's holy and want to discard the rest. And then we're not compassionate to ourselves or to others. because we're always trying to get rid of this yucky side instead of honoring it as being the play of the Tao. It all is. It's not just half of it, all of it. So, in the spirit of iconoclasm, Chuang-Tzu makes fun of Confucius's focus on precepts and rituals. Now, he doesn't make fun of Buddhism's focus on rituals and precepts because Buddhism hasn't come into China yet. That's why he doesn't. People ask me, why didn't he do that? Well, Buddha didn't come into China yet. But he's got Confucius as his fall guy, as his foil. And he emphasizes, both Chuang Tzu and Lao Tzu emphasizes Te, De, the Tao De Ching, the way, the Tao, and its power. De and its virtue. De means virtue. De means power. And so here's I don't remember. I can't remember if this is Lao Tzu or Chuang Tzu talking about it. Superior De, which means virtue and power both, is not De, and thus has De. Inferior De does not let go of De, and thus it is not De. Superior is doing not doing, without trying to be good. Inferior De is active and trying to be good. Simple teaching, isn't it? Simple teaching. So, as much as possible, of course we want to help people. Of course we aspire to being better people. Yes, we do. But we shouldn't try too hard to be good. Because instead, sink into your root. Your root is here. It's right here. This great, wonderful mystery is right here. Always. Always. So I'm going to finish with a final Taoist story. The frog asked the centipede, you know where this is going, right? Which leg do you move first? The centipede stood there for a few minutes, couldn't move, wobbled, and fell down. Then the centipede said to the frog, please don't ask another centipede this question. I've been walking my whole life, and it was never a problem. And now you have killed me completely. I cannot move. 100 legs to move. How can I manage? That's the story. That's the story. So that's what I want to say for today. And I'll do the next two in my talk 4 weeks from now. A little time for questions or comments. Yeah.
I was doing some Wikipedia jumping a few months back, maybe a year back, I don't know, but I read that it is theorized that the rise of icon and statue building and even Mahayana itself is related to the influx of Greeks into India.
Yeah, some people believe that. Could you guys hear what he said? Yeah, some people believe that the development of icons, together with the rise of Mahayana in India, was due to Greek influence. Yeah, some people believe that. Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. Anything more on that?
No.
Interesting. Yeah, it is interesting. Yeah. What else? I think I saw a hand back there someplace. No? What else? Yeah. Sure.
Something that kind of struck me that I've realized recently that I felt while you were talking is as I get deeper into my practice, there's certain things in my life that I see that, you know, I see them differently or I see patterns happening in my life and I do things differently. And I'm starting to see myself in terms of like layers. Like I think I'm going through like this first layer and shedding itself, and then there's going to be like another layer down and it sheds itself. Is there like a bottom?
Did you hear a question? No. So what she says is that she's starting to experience layers of consciousness, layers of and shedding certain layers. And that's wonderful. I mean, that's really a good sign of progress. But don't think too much about it. Don't. If you start thinking about it, you'll be a centipede. But yes, wonderful. It's beginning to see through the veils. They're called the varanas in Buddhism, the veils, to see that they're just made of gossamer. That's all they are. They seem like they're walls, but they're just veils, just gossamer veil. But they're, you see through one, then there's another one, then another one, then another one. And they go on forever, but as you let go of them, you lighten up. You lighten up. You just do. Everything becomes more airy. Everything becomes more spacious. Everything becomes more alive. But is there a bottom? No. No. Because, you know, I upset my son yesterday. I upset my daughter-in-law. Luckily I don't have a cat anymore, so I didn't have a cat to upset. No. But all you have to do is be, notice, be. Apologize if necessary. Sometimes not even apologize. Instead of take it in and start persecuting yourself. I don't understand why you guys persecute yourselves. Well, I understand. I do understand. But geez. So as you begin to see through the layers, much less persecution of yourself and others. Of course, narcissists don't, not to talk about narcissists today, although some of you have heard about one or two. Narcissists don't persecute themselves. They persecute others because they're soul. But anyway, we can let go of that too. We will. We will. We do. Yeah, Charlie.
Yeah, just a little. You talk about perfection and imperfection. And there's a story at 3M about ordering parts from Japan, and they're pretty much perfectionists. They wouldn't allow more than 3 defective parts per 1,000.
Uh-huh.
So you order these parts, they get the 1,000 parts, and then pack it separately. Here's the 3 defective parts you ordered.
That's good. I like that. Did you guys hear him? Uh-huh. Okay. Time for one more, or we'll just move on? One more? Thank you.